It's your inside pass to everything Saints football.
See you later, bye. Touchdown, Rashid Shaheed.
We'll take you to places most fans never go. To practice, to the sideline, to the locker room. Following every twist, turn, and touchdown of the Saints season.
That is going to be a touchdown, Taysom Hill. Taysom TD.
Welcome to Inside Black and Gold.
To the end zone, and that is a touchdown for Chris Olave.
Now, here are your hosts, Steve Geller and Jeff Nowak.
Welcome inside Black and Gold, another pre-draft edition, but we're getting closer and closer to the big day. Steve Geller and Jeff Nowak here with you and anxious to get the first round started. I know that there's been all that speculation leading up to next week.
Yeah, this is the time of year that we keep doing podcasts and keep saying the same thing because there's only so much to talk about. Like, we could come up with like questions and different ways to address it, but we're always going to come back to the same thing.
We're on our mock draft 7.0.
Right. Especially for an episode like this, because there's really no news to speak of over the last several days. So we're really scraping the bottom of the barrel. But this first segment, we are going to get more into draft stuff. We're going to hear from Daniel Jeremiah, the NFL.com analyst. I almost called him an analyst. And he talked about kind of the Saints and their offensive line investment. That's going to be our first time. We're going to talk about that. Second segment, we're going to hear from our friend of the program, Justin Mello. He's going to call in. He's one of the senior analysts for the Draft Network. And as you can imagine, when you have the Draft Network in your title, this is a busy time for you. So
a little bit, right.
We appreciate him making the time. We'll get him on the phone. Don't think he's going to be on camera, but you YouTubers can live with it. And then in the final segment, I got a question on Twitter that I did not have the energy in my body to get into a Twitter debate about whether Derek Carr is a franchise quarterback or not. But hey, we can talk about it on the tube. And I also want to dive into what makes a good Stan, because I feel like it's funny because we made fun of Jameis 101 a lot when Jameis was here. And I think he got a bad rap because in reality, there's Stans for everybody. And he was just an easy target because he was overt about it, which you almost have to give him credit for that. Like, at least he told you what he was. He didn't have some random name with an animated picture that it was like, I wonder if all of his tweets are about this. Oh, there they are. Okay, anyway, so we'll get back to that. But yeah, the first segment, we can go through a couple things. Shamar John Charles got re-signed. They put him in 27, which how disrespectful to Ike Yadam. I'm sorry, I'm not going to do that again. And then Charlie Smith got his number, which it just feels right that we go through the numbers because we spent so much time last week talking about the numbers. He'll be in 39, which is an interesting punter number. I think Lou Headley's also in the 30s, if I recall correctly. But yeah, nothing really to speak of from a signing standpoint. So we're kind of just looking at the draft. And then once we get through the draft, we'll have a much better idea of who they might need to target in free agency.
Yeah, you look at with the signing of John Charles. And it was one of those, they're like, wait a minute, he was on the team last year.
He played late in the year.
Right, yeah, didn't ring a bell at all.
He was in the game against the Falcons because Ike Yadam got hurt, and then Alante Taylor went into the slot, and then I can't remember, someone else got hurt, and he actually was out there. Take that for what it is. They like him, so they brought him back. It kind of reminds me that, like, last year, like, if you recall, this is the time of year where they re-signed Ike Yadam and everyone was like, he didn't really do much last year, but they clearly like him because they brought him back. So, hey, maybe he's this year's Ike Yadam. I don't know. He's in that number. Maybe 27 is the magic number for those cornerbacks that you expect nothing out of and get a contribution from. I don't know.
Yeah, which Shamar, obviously still a young cat. He's 25 years old out of App State, fifth round pick in, 2021?
Yep. Two App State guys on the roster. Can you name the other one?
Why can't I think of it? Who is it?
DeMarco Jackson, also a fifth round pick. So they can hang out.
Right.
Talk about upstate North Carolina. That's where App State is, right? It's North Carolina. Anyway, it's Appalachians. But all right, let's go forward here. So Daniel Jeremiah did his typical pre-draft conference call, and I was not on it because I have sat on that conference call, those conference calls so many enough times, waited an hour and a half, and then given up. So now I just let other people do it. But I do go through and listen to it. And there was a good question about the Saints. It was from Adam Devine. He's one of the hosts of the Saints Block Party pod, previously Saints Twitter pod, I think. They changed the name.
How does he get in the key to ask a question? Because I've done the same thing as you, where I've been a part of it, and I feel like I've been in line to get a question in, and they never got to me.
Well, that's why I want to give him credit, because this was about, like, I don't know, an hour 40 in. So, like, I have to give him credit for the commitment, because it's more than I have. Like, I get frustrated and I give up after about 90 minutes, because they don't put a list out. They just kind of say, okay, you're up next. You don't know if, like, you're 10 away, 5 away. You're just kind of there. And then all of a sudden they're like, oh, it's your question. And you have to kind of, like, slap yourself in the face, wake up and ask it. So I give him all the credit in the world. He waited on there. He asked him a question. It was a good question. And I want to give those guys credit. I think they hate me personally. I don't know. Like, Adam's got me blocked on Twitter. I guess he just blocks everybody. But I appreciate what they do. I appreciate their podcast. Go check it out. They do a good job. And they engage with fans really well. I think podcasts like that are valuable. So, you know, if you want to go check it out, go check it out. But so he's the one asking the question. That's why I'm saying this. So I don't want to give him credit for asking the question before we use it here. But he's going to ask about the offensive line and the investment. I did trim it down a little bit. But we got the crux of it. So here you go.
The Saints have heavily invested in the offensive line, early premium draft capital. And with the draft capital they've invested, you would kind of expect that they should have, like, a top five type of offensive line. And that just hasn't been the case. With players not working out, like Penning and, you know, Reese is serviceable, is it a coaching issue or is it a scouting issue?
I think that's a great question. I would say it's a combination. You know, I don't think you make first round picks really anymore unless your coaches and your personnel department are on the same page for the most part, or else one of you is leaving, right? And whether the coach is on the way out or the GM's on the way out. But I think there's usually alignment when those decisions are made. So I think the blame you can spread around. I think, you know, some of those players, why they didn't work out, I don't think there's any connection to it. When I look through those guys and rolling through that list of names that you just rattled off there, I mean, Penning, like, if we, you know, that's the most recent in terms of the one that you might be already replacing. The size was there, obviously the temperament and the tenacity and the willingness to work and all that stuff was there. He just, you know, balance was an issue for him coming out. And that is has been kind of a killer for him when he's been in the NFL. So that's that particular one. But I don't think you can shy away from it. It's so important. And it's a position group that, it dictates a lot of your success, not only as an offense, but as a team. I don't think you can say, well, we have, you know, it's been a blind spot for us. So let's draft another position so we don't make another mistake. You just got to suck it up and keep swinging. And they've got to get that solved if they're going to be where they want to be. So, I think you got to try and learn your lessons from the mistakes you've made in the past, but they've got to get right back on the horse. And I don't really see how they go any other direction, but, you know, offensive tackle with their first pick and where they are with this draft, they should be able to get that accomplished. But, every organization has issues with certain positions. I've been on organizations, you know, when I was in Baltimore, we couldn't get the receiver thing figured out and they just kept swinging and kept swinging. And then all of a sudden last year you look up and you see Zay Flowers out there. It looks like a superstar. So you got to keep swinging.
Yeah. I thought that was an interesting answer in a few ways. And it kind of gets you wondering, okay, did the Saints miss on a couple picks, or are they just bad at drafting the offensive line? Are they just bad at evaluating the offensive line? And it's tough because, while yes, you did have the Trevor Penning pick, you know, Cesar Ruiz, while he's a serviceable guard, is he a first round guard, or did you reach for him? I'd land on the fact that you reached for him, even though it wasn't a terrible pick, because I think he is a entrenched starting right guard, which that's like the baseline that you have to reach. But then you go back and you, like, Ryan Ramczyk was a good pick on the offensive line. I think Andres Pete was a solid pick on the offensive line. He's a three-time Pro Bowler. What are your expectations for a mid-first-round pick? That's got to be in that range, right? You would have preferred for him to be a guard, but you had Teron Armstead, a guy you found in the third round. So he was never going to be your left tackle while Teron was here. So, I mean, I it's tough because it's not like you can point to it and say, man, they always miss when they draft offensive linemen. But when you do miss, and Scott Shanley talked about this when we had him on WWL recently. I think we played the audio on this podcast. When you miss with those big guys in the first round, it sets you back and it's a problem. And, you know, I don't think they've given up on Trevor Penning yet, but I do think you have to start reevaluating, okay, is our process what it needs to be? And do we need to figure out different ways to evaluate this? Maybe some of the things we're looking for are not working, are not the markers that we thought they were in terms of predicting future success. I think we're going to find out this year, because I think there's a few different ways you could approach this draft pick, this number 14 pick. And do you want a guy you could, hey, is it a ready-made pass protecting left tackle? Is it a road grading right tackle? Is it a guy who's kind of in the middle in J.C. Latham? This road grading right tackle would be Taliese Fuanga. The ready-made pass protector would be Olu Fashanu. Do you trade up? Do you feel really good about a guy and you make sure you go get him? Or do you let the board kind of tell you who you're going to get? It's tough. We're going to find out on Thursday. But one way or the other, you can't miss again. I don't know what happens if you miss again, but I do know that you're going to be in a serious load of trouble if you miss again. And you might be in a load of trouble even if you hit, but that process better be on point this draft.
Yeah, you can't even blame like a small school, you know, being an issue with a guy like Penning, because obviously you brought up a guy, you know, Teron Armstead was a huge pickup for this team and a success. And then you mentioned Ruiz has kind of been a mid-range guy. That's from a big school like Michigan. So, you know, I hear a lot of folks saying that the Saints are targeting these small schools too much and need to stay within, like, the SEC. That's just not the case, I don't feel like, at least.
Well, I mean, if you want to expand it out to other positions, then you're talking about, like, a Marcus Davenport, guys like that. But
sure.
At the offensive line, yeah, I mean, Ryan Ramczyk was Wisconsin, Andres Pete was Stanford, Eric McCoy was Texas A&M. Yeah, Penning is really the only small school guy in terms of a high draft pick. Obviously, Nick Saldivari was Old Dominion, so you could talk about that. But I do think, like, if you're the Saints, if you're a Saints fan and you're hoping for the best, you're looking at this as a glass half full thing, it's the development was not what you needed it to be, and hopefully you have fixed that issue, because that's really the only fix that the Saints have implemented beyond, you know, adding a couple, you know, scouting pieces that can give you some fresh insights and fresh eyes. I think Cody Rager is out of the door and he went to Denver, so you have some different inputs that you might not have had previously. But the real only significant change you have made, other than maybe, hey, their process changes somewhere that we can't see it, is you've got a new offensive line coach. You've got a new offensive coaching staff, and you're hoping that kind of jumpstarts some of the development that you didn't see last year from Trevor, and that maybe kind of stalled a little bit with Caesar, and that you can see from a rookie that you bring in. Now, I will say that, you know, we talked a lot about this. The Saints have put themselves in a precarious position in regard to the offensive line, in that, man, they have some serious depth needs that, you know, because an injury cropped up, which you should be planning ahead for injuries. I don't think they have been as much as they should be, but you happen to be in a draft where, you know, in 2022, you would not be able to get these offensive tackles at 14, any of them. In 2022, when there was no quarterbacks, really, the wide receiver class was really strong, but you know, you need multiple positions to push down these tackles the way that will be happening on Thursday. And you happen to be in a draft where three quarterbacks are guaranteed to go in the top five. Another quarterback will probably go in the top 10 in J.J. McCarthy. You have three wide receivers that will probably go in the top 10 in Marvin Harrison Jr., Malik Nabers, Roma Dunze. So that means that these top end tackles that would probably be in the top five in another draft year are going 8, 10, 12, 14. So you've locked out if you're the Saints in terms of being in that range where you don't have to trade up to go get them in the first place. You better hit. And, you know, the question that I meant to ask previously early on, and we never actually said it, can this, how many more bad to middling to mediocre draft classes can this front office survive? And I would say one. I think if you cannot turn things around in 2024 with a board that suits your needs and two picks in the top 45, if you cannot find two starters from that group and at least one that makes an impact as a rookie, that's then you're looking at, you know, you go back to 2017, that draft kind of jump-started everything. Since then, you have really been struggling to find impact players. Like, you got Chris Olave, but you paid a premium to get him. You know, like, there's the you got impacts from a, you know, Carl Granderson that maybe you didn't expect. You got impacts from some defensive players that maybe you didn't expect. But it's the draft classes have not been strong enough. And I think that's got to change this year. And you've got to kind of open your eyes and be like, okay, maybe we do some things differently. Because to me, like, everyone can talk about Derek Carr. You can talk about the free agent signing, some of the issues that in the roster construction and the salary cap management. But to me, the biggest issue has been draft asset management and missing on draft picks and not getting any impact whatsoever from too many draft picks. And so that's got to change this year, or there are going to be changes next year and the year beyond, in my opinion.
You brought up Olave, and yeah, I consider him a success, but I mean, he hasn't put himself
any of those wide receivers would have been a success.
He's not in that elite category though of wide receivers right now in the NFL.
I think he is. I disagree.
You put him in that upper tier?
Yes. I put him in the top 10. Yeah. I mean, he's got back-to-back 1,000-yard seasons, and he hasn't even really been the focal point of the offense. Like, if he can stay healthy, that's my biggest question with him, is he's a slighter guy, you know, and it's like not a coincidence that he's getting hurt, right? Like, he's got to learn how to protect himself a little better, I think. And people will blame Derek, and sure, maybe Derek has to do a better job of putting him in positions to not take big hits because of the type of receiver he is, in that, you know, he's not a big guy. And so, like, you got to be aware that, hey, we can't hang him out to dry over the middle of the field. You know, he's not going to battle through some of these hits that a Mike Thomas would. But I've been watching the broadcast versions of last year's games. And man, that dude, like I said this as a rookie, he's always open. He's just always open. You just got to get him the ball and let him run. And that's why the fact that he didn't have any yak as a rookie was mind-boggling to me, because it's like he's always standing by himself because he's just able to make cuts that these defenders can't even get near. And I think as a focal point of an offense, you know, I could see him averaging 100 yards a game. So it's really just a matter of how many games he plays.
Yeah, for me, like I said, I think he's a great talent. I would put him top 20, just not my top 10 of wide receivers right now in the NFL.
I mean, he's probably closer to 10 than he is to 8, in my opinion. Like, I think he would probably be 10 in my list. Because but that's kind of based on, like, I think he's going to take a big leap this year as the true number one in that offense. And it's just going to be a matter of, okay, how many games can he play? Because I think you just plug 100 yards in for every game, and that's what you're looking at. I don't think he's ever going to be like a 10 to 15 touchdown guy, but I think he's going to rack up yards. He's going to rack up catches, and he's going to move the chains. And it's just going to be about, okay, how can you build around that and make the offense work around that? You got to have a running game. Like, the fact is, he was a 1,000-yard receiver with no running game. And really, you know, in the second half of the season, it was just him and Rashid. You know, like, you don't think defenses were keying on him? So, I don't know. I think with another year with Derek, I think he's going to have a monster season. So, you know, you could say, hey, as of last year, maybe he wasn't a top 10 receiver. But I think going into 2024 and kind of projecting, I would put him in the top 10.
I hope you're right. I'll put that down on my fantasy football board.
Yeah, we'll see. All I know is you got a top wide receiver. Got to keep him happy. Got to throw him the ball. And so, either way, that's not what we're here to talk about. But yeah, I mean, Chris was like one of the biggest wins of the last several years. But again, it's like,
right,
you trade number 10, you could have gone with any of those top wide receivers other than Jameson Williams and feel like, hey, we got a good one here. So, like, that was kind of like drafting on easy mode. But you needed it and you got it. So I'm not going to complain about it. It's just a lot of these picks that you kind of went off the wall with. And, you know, and you can't look at Peyton Turner and say, like, hey, it was a missed evaluation, because we don't know. I mean, like, you can't look in your crystal ball and be like, oh, yeah, this guy's going to get hurt every time he goes on the field. But it would be nice if you could.
No, the Saints would definitely like that information. I don't know what to make of Turner. I know we're going a little off key here, but with him, it's very frustrating because you feel like there have been those little glimpses of the vision that the Saints saw But again, too far and few between because he's not on the field.
Yeah, and I mean, just to kind of pull it back to the conversation we were talking about, is it an issue with the evaluation?
Yeah.
Or is it just bad luck? And you have, you can't, like Daniel was saying, you can't look at a miss and say, well, we're just going to not draft that position again because clearly we can't figure it out. You have to look at your process and say, did we do everything right? Because sometimes you can do everything right and it doesn't work, right? Like sometimes, you know, you make a perfect pass, the receiver runs a perfect route, the ball bounces off your helmet, right? You can't, that's just bad luck. Someone, like something in the process broke down and, you know, you get your cleat caught in the turf and you fell. Like you can't look at that and say, well, we shouldn't run that route anymore. You say, well, that sucks, but what do? You just get back on the horse and try it again because you feel like you did it the right way. And so with a Peyton Turner, I asked Jeff Ireland about this because it's like, it's frustrating. And he basically said, like, yeah, we feel like we nailed that evaluation, but what can you do about that? They feel the same way about Marcus Davenport, right? It was like, we got the guy we thought we wanted, but things happened. So I think that's the same thing with offensive line. It's like, okay, is your look at your process, and if you feel like you nailed the process, then yeah, do it again. But you better be right that you nailed the process, because if you do it again and it ends up failing the same way, then it is your process. So that's why I think this is kind of a make or break draft for this front office, for this scouting department, and for the head coach. Because, you know, like, how many chances do you get?
Not many. NFL stands for not for long. I learned that exactly. Long ago.
Exactly. But all right, let's wrap up that segment, and we'll keep right on the draft. This is Inside Black and Gold. We're going to bring in Justin Mello of the Draft Network, get his input. This guy talks to dozens and dozens and dozens, hundreds of these prospects every year. I don't know where he finds the time, but he always has some great input. Looking forward to it. So stick around on Inside Black and Gold. Subscribe. We will be right back. And we're back here on Inside Black and Gold. Jeff Nowak alongside Steve Geller, as always, and promised one of the busiest people in the country these days because he works for the Draft Network, and the draft is right around the corner. Justin Mello. How you doing, Justin? Thanks for giving us the time.
Doing well, Jeff. Doing well, man. Appreciate you for having me on.
No doubt. No doubt. So what are you up to these days? Give us kind of a snapshot of your, you know, we are 7 days prior to the draft. What does your day-to-day look like right now?
Well, we're putting the bow on the interview series. You know, if you've followed my work at all for the last, you know, 10 years or so, I've developed an interview series where I sit down with prospects in the NFL draft. This is the busiest year I've ever had. You know, I'm proud to say that the series is in high demand. You know, front offices around the league and agencies and whatnot. I had six of them today. It's 2 p.m. right now. I've had six interviews today with these players, and I'm closing in on number 200. So 200 players in the 2024 NFL draft from January to now. So only for the last 3 months or so, 200 players. It's the highest I've ever done. I think last year I had 150. So I'm used to being pretty busy, but 200 is a new high. So very, very glad with how the series played out this year.
That number is crazy. I know one guy that you talked to was Mason Smith, the guy that people in Louisiana will know. Defensive tackle for LSU that came in with all the hype in the world, but I never really got a chance to live up to it, I would say, especially with the injury. But I have had people tell me don't be surprised if Mason Smith goes a lot earlier than people might be projecting him to go. What were your kind of reads on Mason, and where do you expect to see him land this year?
Well, I'm going to tell you the exact same thing. You know, I think it's funny when you look at, you know, mock drafts, big boards around the league, you can kind of tell who's in the know and who isn't. You know, I think it was Daniel Jeremiah who had him as like a top 50 player rather early on his big board. And I honestly think that is the range he's going to go in. I think he's probably a day two guy. It wouldn't shock me if he creeps into the second round. I think, you know, as you said, the potential was what it was, and it still is what it is. You know, I think teams are still convinced that he's capable of reaching that ceiling. I think you saw it in flashes and spurts. at times at LSU when he was healthy. He had a really good pro day workout. He's been on like 12, you know, top 30 pre-draft visits. So there's a lot of interest in him. You know, the Saints brought him in for one. I didn't clarify, but I anticipate that doesn't count towards their 30 designation, right? You're allowed to bring in players with a local connection. I think it's actually a really weird rule. People don't realize it depends on whether or not you provide transportation as to whether or not it counts towards your 30 designation or not. So, you know, I think if you do, it does count as a 30. If you don't, then you're allowed to bring in, you know, 30 other guys to the facility. So either way, they brought him in for what was like a 30 like visit. It's the same thing, right? You get to go, you get to conduct a medical if you want to. You can watch the film, show them around the facility, meet with coaches and scouts, yada yada. Essentially a job interview is what it is, right? An in-person job interview. So he had one with the Saints and he had one with 11 other teams. So there's a lot of interest in Mason Smith right now.
So like as long as you send him a town car, like it doesn't count.
it's a really strange rule. Yeah, I literally learned it this year. I knew that you were allowed to bring in local guys without them counting towards a 30 designation. What I didn't know is I guess what determines that or not has to actually do with the transportation. Like I talked to a guy the other day that visited the Colts on a 30 and it wasn't, I believe it was considered a local because it was like a 4-hour drive and him and his agent made the drive themselves or something like that. So it's a really, really intriguing rule that makes that determination.
Just curious about with Mason, did he explain why he decided to enter the draft and not go back to college for one more year, figuring it could boost his stock even more?
I didn't ask him that question, in all honesty, Steve. We just kind of talked about that. We did talk a lot about the year that he had coming off the injury. Perhaps, you know, this context will answer your question. But he did sort of state that he felt that, you know, he was really proud of the way he came back from the injury and the type of season he strung together this past year. Felt he was fully healthy, felt he was, you know, pretty darn close to reaching his performance ceiling, and then was really happy with the numbers he put up at the pro day. So the impression I sort of got was that, you know, he's really, really proud of the year that he had.
You know, kind of shifting sides of the line here, Saints obviously pick at 14. And, you know, I've had a lot of people ask me, okay, who would you pick? What offensive lineman would you pick? And every time it's like, it's tough because the board's, if you stick at 14, the board's kind of going to tell you who you pick. You don't really get to decide between, you know, Fuanga or Olufoshanu or JC Latham. It's just a matter of who's still there. Like, you're pretty confident one's going to be there, but you don't know which one. So, I mean, I guess I'm going to eliminate the board for you and just say, if we'll take Joe Alt out of the equation because he's certainly not going to be there unless they trade. You know, if between those guys, between Fuanga, Olufoshanu, we can add Fatanu if you want, JC Latham. If you're the Saints and you could pick between any of those four guys, obviously you can't. Who would be your pick and why?
Well, I'll say this. Out of the ones you mentioned, I've got the highest grade on Olufoshanu from Penn State. You know, I think.
Have you ever said his name wrong?
It, you know what? I only learned this about a month ago. It's Fashanu. I didn't. Yeah. It's Olufoshanu. I got the highest grade on him. I mean, entering this year, when he went back last year, I'll be honest, I thought he was going to be the first tackle drafted last year. Now, I don't know that would have came to fruition because Paris Johnson, I think, ended up going 6, I think it was. But when he went back, I thought he was the best tackle in school. And this year, you know, there are a couple of rough moments, ups and downs. For the most part, though, I thought it was ups. Like, I'm higher on him than most. I'm a little surprised when I see him going like 2021 in mock drafts. I think he's better than that. The interesting thing for the Saints and you know, taking into consideration, you said eliminate the board. Well, it's wide open to them because I think they can go left tackle or right tackle. Now, that might be a bit unfortunate depending on how you look at it, right? But no one knows what's happening over there with Ryan Ramczyk on the right and the future of his health. And then obviously, you know, Trevor Penning hasn't lived up to expectations on the left. So that kind of opens up the board. You know, a left tackle is always in demand, whether it's Fashanu, a guy like Troy Fatanu, who I think is going to go in that range as well, is an intriguing one. Or they can go with the right tackle like JC Latham, right? Or Talese Fuaga. And then I would probably include Amarius Mims in that mix there somewhere. I think they're in a good position to stick at 14 and get a good one. What will be interesting is, and people don't realize this enough, they're not going to like all of them. right? They're going to like some of them and not like some of the others, right? So do they stick at 14 and have confidence that one of the ones they like is going to make it there? Or do they try trading up a little to get the one that they want? I think there are, you know, probably not going high enough to get Joe Alt, as you said. But once you get to that, you know, the ninth pick, I see the Bears, who only have four picks in this draft, you know, maybe they'd be willing to move down to acquire some capital. I see the Jets at 10, you know, maybe would consider moving down. I think after that, you're probably just sticking at 14. I don't think, you know, the Vikings, Broncos, are those teams are looking to move up as opposed to moving down. So if they can't get to 9 or 10, it probably makes the most sense for them to just stick at 14 and take the best tackle there.
Justin, curious your take here. A lot of mock drafts I've been doing. Obviously, tackles, the offensive tackle, huge need for this team, for the Saints. And looks like it, you know, they're gearing up to be that selection for round one at number 14. But what if a guy like Brock Bowers, a tight end, slips to you? He's available. Obviously, that kind of weapon in the Saints offense would be really welcome. But after looking at the history of tight ends taken in the first round, you're kind of second guessing that.
Well, I think he's one of the best players in this draft, right? Bar none. I think that's obvious. And I'm going to tell people what I've been telling, you know, about Brock Bowers. It's like, if I told you he was a slot receiver, would it still bother you? You know what I mean? If they drafted a slot receiver that early, well, he played like 60% of his snaps from the slot or out wide. Or more. It was around that number. So this guy's really like a wide receiver first and foremost, before anything else. So he's a passing game weapon. He's an elite passing game weapon. And if you remove the positional value from the conversation, I think there's no doubt that he's one of the best 14, you know, the Saints pick 14. He's one of the best 14 players in the draft. So if you can get past that part of it, you look at the way he's going to be used at the next level. I don't think whoever drafts him is going to ask him to do a whole lot of inline blocking. You know, I think he's good enough, you know, adequate enough to do a little bit of it. He's not useless there, but you're taking him away from what he does at an elite level. And that's produce receptions for receiving yards and touchdowns. So, and look, the Saints need another pass catcher, right? I don't love what they have behind Chris Olave right now. So, if you factor in that he's a guy that's going to play a position that catches the ball for you at a very high level, then you just go ahead and draft him and call it a day.
You know, I had someone on YouTube tell me that it doesn't make sense to draft wide receivers in the second round. And I had to do a double take because I was like, wait, what?
What did you say?
Second right. round is a perfect place to draft wide receivers because you look at, I mean, even last year alone, you get Jaden Reed and Rashee Rice obviously is dealing with off the field stuff, but he had a great rookie season. And so I guess my question for you would be, you know, what second round wide receiver do you have the highest grade on? Because, you know, obviously Keon Coleman's a popular name. Xavier Leggett's a popular name. But I think there are a handful of really interesting prospects. So what are your kind of reads on that?
Well, there are a bunch of them. You know, like you just mentioned two of them that I would list certainly, but there are others that interest me as well. And I think I agree, that's a perfect spot to draft a receiver. You know, a perfect spot. I mean, I got to stop using this example. It's probably getting a little outdated, but I always think back to the A.J. Brown, Deebo Samuel, DK Metcalf year. Like, what an insane year. I think there was another one. I'm slipping my mind right now, but there was a bunch of second round receivers that year that turned into unbelievable number one receivers. So it's a perfect spot. And I think the Saints are in a good spot to grab one in the second round. In fact, I think they should, right, based on the depth chart behind Chris Olave right now. I've got really, you know, high grades on the ones you just mentioned, Xavier Leggett specifically, but I also really like, you know, Ladd McConkey out of Georgia. I think I've got a really high grade on him. I don't have a second round grade on Ricky Pearsall. I know a lot of people do. I see more of like a third rounder when I watch a tape on him. But here are two guys that I'm absolutely infatuated with. And if they make it there, I don't understand why they would. But there was a story that came out yesterday with diabetes with one of that was on Bob McGinn's article. If you read that every year, it's a really good piece. But Adonai Mitchell and Brian Thomas Jr. are guys that I've got like an elite first round grade on. You know, you're talking about guys that are 6'3", 205 pounds and run the 40-yard dash in like 4.34 seconds or better. Like Brian Thomas Jr. What led the nation in touchdowns this year? Both of them had like 1,000 yards. Like these are, you know, they check every box from a size, athleticism, production standpoint. I love both of those guys. So if they end up in the second round, I don't think they should, but indications are they might. If they do, they will be far and away my highest graded second round receivers. But I like a bunch of them. The ones you mentioned, Xavier Leggett, you know, Keon Coleman, I think there's some boom or bust potential there. You always worry with those, you know, big body guys that are vertical playmakers that sort of, you know, rely on contested catchability. It's the age old question. Is he going to be T. Higgins or is he going to be N'Keal Harry? Right. That's what teams have to sort through with him. But there are a ton of, you know, high level receivers in the second round of this draft.
Looking for me, at least from the offensive line to the D line now, another pick that number 14 I've seen pretty popular for the Saints in many mocks. Byron Murphy, curious your take on the defensive lineman from Texas.
I think he's going to be the first defensive tackle drafted. I think there's a, you know, I'd be surprised if he gets out of the top 20. I saw some top 10 buzz this morning. That'd be a little rich for me, but I look at teams like the Cincinnati Bengals, you know, the Los Angeles Rams. I think they've got back-to-back picks around 18, 19. You know, with the Bengals losing DJ Reader this offseason and the Rams obviously losing Aaron Donald, I think there's a need for a guy like that. I think he's going to be one of those dominant three techs at the next level that can rush the passer, you know, very much in that mold of a Quinnen Williams, a Jeffrey Simmons, you know, the highest paid guys at that position. I'd be stunned. You know, I see a lot of people out there comparing him to Johnny Newton from Illinois. I love Johnny Newton and the production that he's had, but you know, he didn't get to test throughout this process. He had an injury, he had surgery. I think that's going to drop him down the board a little. So I'd be shocked if Byron Murphy wasn't the first defensive tackle drafted.
All right, Justin Mello of the Draft Network. One more quick question, and I'll let you go. One sleeper pick, day three pick that you would identify as a sleeper that you really like that might be flying under the radar, who would it be?
Oh, gosh, that's a tough question because there's so many of them. I like so many. I'd probably round off a ton of names. Not a lot of small schoolers, but like, you know, Blake Watson from Memphis is a dynamic running back, outstanding, you know, change of pace, burst, and long speed. I'll give you one with a bit of a local connection. I love Jaquan Jackson, the wide receiver from Tulane. He was at the Senior Bowl. It's funny. I talked to a scout that week and then Jim Nagy separately. I don't know if they had the same conversation because it was odd. Both of them said to me in separate conversations, individual conversations, that he's garnered comparisons to Zay Flowers of the Baltimore Ravens. He's electric, dynamic, you know, short area twitchiness and explosiveness. I would pound the table for Jaquan Jackson in this draft. I can go on and on. You know, there are offensive linemen that I really like. Christian Haynes from UConn, I think, is a lot better than he's getting credit for. There are a couple edge rushers, Austin Booker out of Kansas. I'm a fan of Mo Kamara out of Colorado State. A bit of a small guy, but uber productive down there. There's a tackle out of Augustana University that has a great chance to get drafted. Exactly, a school no one's ever heard of, repped by the same agent as John Michael Schmitz. So there's a lot of intrigue there. There's the tackle out of from my neck of the woods, although we're on opposite coasts. But Giovanni Manu, have you heard of this guy from the University of British Columbia? Didn't even play college football in the States. He's got 13 top 30 visits. This guy ran a 4.96. Hear me out, a 4.96. At 6'7", 355 pounds. It is completely unheard. He's got Tongan heritage. So, you know, he's one of those big bodied guys. It's in the bloodline, right? Roman Reigns, the WWE, like the guy is just a freak of nature, a 4.96 at 6'7", 355, 13 top 30 visits for him. There's another kid. Have you heard of the kid from my neck of the woods, Juantez Stiggers? Have you heard of this story? This guy is going to become next weekend, I think, the third player ever, okay, the third prospect ever to be drafted without playing a single game of college football. Okay, it is complete, not one career game of college football. This kid, hear me out, okay? He was committed to an HBCU, okay, way back when. So he was talented enough to play college ball. There was no denying that. Well, that was when the season got canceled due to COVID, their year did. And then one of his close family members passed away a few months later, really, you know, devastated him. So he left the program and went home to be with his family. Okay, by the time he's ready to go back, not a whole lot of opportunity in college. What does he do? He's got a regular job, okay? Someone convinces him to go play in the fan-controlled league. You remember that thing, like 7-on-7 indoor ball? Okay, he goes to fan-controlled league. shout out to the scouts who are up my neck of the woods, because he ends up landing with the Toronto Argonauts of the Canadian Football League this past season. Guess what? He won CFL Defensive Rookie of the Year this past year. Okay. He was outstanding for the Argonauts, hit the ground running. Okay. Burst explosion. It's legitimate with him. So he's going to get drafted on day three, from what I understand. He's another one. He's had like 12 or 13 visits with teams. Like, we've been trying to nail this kid down for an interview. It's supposed to happen this weekend. We can't get him because he's in a different city every single day. So this guy, so you asked me for one. I think I might have given you 10. But if you haven't heard of the kid in the CFL, I mean, it's one of the best stories you'll hear this pre-draft cycle.
I was going to say, that's an awesome story.
Remember the name when you see it on draft weekend, Quantes Stiggers. When he gets drafted, it's probably going to have to say the Toronto Argonauts of the CFL, because he didn't play college ball anywhere. So it'll definitely be a unique one for years to come.
No doubt. I do apologize for giving you the longest answer for that question on the shortest question. Anyway,
my own thanks fault. So much,
Justin Mello of the Draft Network. Check him out. Justin_NFL. It, more draft content than you'll know what to do with. Go check it out. And I know you're busy, Justin. I do appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on, guys. You know where to find me.
You the man.
Take care, guys. Bye-bye.
Oh, yeah. As always, you know, it's funny because in my head I was like, oh, just give me one and then we'll move on.
And he was like, oh, I've got like 20.
Yeah, as I finished asking the question, I was like, he's not going to be capable of giving me just one. What am I thinking? I'm a fool. Because he was like, he has like 15 minutes on the dot, so I didn't want to keep him any longer than, but hey, you know, there you go.
Hopefully the Saints are listening to our podcast too, and I'm sure they know about Quantes Stiggers now.
Hey, the Saints have been, you know, pretty familiar with the Canada players, yeah. Right? Like David Onyemata was University of Manitoba, I want to say. Is it, right. Regina? I can't remember. His nickname was the Manitoba Mauler, not Colin Saunders. Nathan Shepherd was also from a Toronto suburb. I don't really understand how it all works because it's like an entire town, but it's technically a Toronto suburb. But, you know, so if there are Canadian players, you know, they've scouted them. They're usually aware of those Canadian exports. So interesting. And a lot of day three picks to choose from. So they will have ammunition if they want to. But all right, let's wrap up that segment. A lot of great information there to tide you over until draft day. I'll have to go through and I guess I'll go write up all of those sleeper picks, because half of them I hadn't heard of. Can go from there. But this is Inside Black and Gold. We'll be coming right back. Talk a little bit about Derek Carr and, you know, but more so NFL stands, right? How are they handling the offseason and what makes a good stand? We could talk about that.
Not the Eminem Dido song?
I mean, I think that's where it comes from.
The term came from, yeah.
I'm pretty sure. I think that's literally the origin of the term stan in that context. Yeah. He's not gonna... that was gross. I'm sorry I did that to you. Sorry I did that to your ears. But all right, this is Inside Black and Gold. We will be right back. Inside Black and Gold. One more segment here. I'm Jeff Nowak. He is Steve Geller. Subscribe wherever you get your podcast, YouTube, whatever. You made it all the way to the third segment here. We got to be doing something right. Let us know. Give us a review. Whatever. But first things first, I got to know, Steve, what are your thoughts on Twitter stands for NFL players?
Twitter, just in general, is a terrible cesspool of nonsense, but it's still something like, of all the social media platforms, I'm still most geared into that just because of the way the information comes to you. Everything is so instant, obviously, but there's just so many trolls out to get a rise out of folks, looking to stir the pot, as you would say. But the stands out there, I don't know. We mentioned Jameis one of one, obviously, earlier, was a huge one that we dealt with locally. I'll give him credit. He could twist any stat to make Jameis Winston look like a future Hall of Famer. It was unbelievable.
He was good at it. You know, I kind of put those on the opposite side of the equation. There are trolls and there are stands. And I, you know, I can't hate the stands because in most cases, they're just trying to be positive about a specific player. Whereas a troll was just trying to talk shit constantly. And so if I had to pick between 100% stands and 100% trolls, I would pick stands every time. And it's kind of brought me to thinking, like, what makes a good stan, right? Because I would argue that Jameis one of one is like the gold standard.
Absolutely. Well, anything Jameis does, elevate. Yeah.
The gold standard, right, of stands. Because like he, and the one thing that they all do well is they have screenshots. Like, and because you can't lie about the screenshot. And it was
it's
like
right one in front of you. Here's the facts.
The funniest one he had was like a list. He was like, Jameis Winston is the first quarterback to ever throw for like 5,108 yards. It was like, why is that number? Because it was like Pat Mahomes or black quarterback to ever throw for that many. Because it was like Pat Mahomes had like 5,098 yards or something like that. And it was like, oh, we got to put it here. Otherwise, there's no stat. But no, it was funny. And every preloaded. And I give him credit. I give all these guys credit when they're, it's like when you're well researched, you might as well use that information. And it's just, I don't know. Like, this is the time of year where I don't engage on a lot of that stuff because I just don't have the energy to argue about something that's meaningless, especially on Twitter this time of year. But one of those, and I would call this guy a stan, and I think he would call himself a stan. There's a few guys, you know, people call me a stan for Derek Carr just because I don't hate the guy. And I always find it funny because it was like, but the stands yell at me for not being nice enough to Derek. So I feel like that means I'm in the right space.
Both sides.
If the stands were too much, too happy about me, then I would feel like it's like, maybe I am being a little soft. And if the trolls were too much on my side, it'd be like, So as long as I'm in the middle where I get like 50% angry at me at any given time, I feel like I've done my job.
No, I think you've been plenty critical of Derek, but not overly. And I think that's right where the folks that hate Carr kind of appreciate it. And then the stands, I guess, maybe
yeah, that's the sweet spot. It's the sweet
right,
spot.
Exactly.
Right. But okay. So this guy, he's definitely a stan, but he listens to our podcast and he's always in the mailbags. And so I do want to answer his question, but I just did not have the energy to dive into this on Twitter. Okay. So I didn't do it, but I did see it. I needed to know I saw it. I just did not reply to it. And I'm not going to go through the stats. You can see, if you're watching this on YouTube, you can see all the stats he laid out. Basically, he's looking at four seasons for four different quarterbacks. I'm not playing the guessing game of who they are, but he's pointing out that, hey, Derek Carr's stats are in line with a lot of these guys who are probably viewed as quote-unquote franchise quarterbacks, guys that you would say, hey, they drive success with their teams. And his question is, and a fair question, is how much of that is just the narrative around a particular player versus actually being a franchise elevating player? Because so much of the time you're really just looking at wins and losses, which are not a quarterback stat. As much credit and blame as we give quarterbacks, wins and losses can't only be attributed to the quarterback. That said, they have the biggest impact on that of any player, any individual player on the field. So they are going to get undue blame and undue credit when it goes well. That's just how it works. That's part of the deal of being a quarterback. But is Derek Carr overly criticized for not driving winning more so than some of these other guys around the league? You look at guys who have not won, right? When I look at it and I say, okay, if you want to be viewed, the perception of your career is inevitably going to be, how many winning seasons did you have, right? How many trips to the playoffs have you made? And how many games in the playoffs have you won? I don't need Super Bowls, but I do need you to show me that you can go win in the postseason, because until you do that, I don't believe you can. I think the postseason is a different game and not every quarterback is suited for it. And it's really not one that you can project. I think you just have to be in that moment before you can see whether that is the case. I kind of like it. So Derek, I kind of liken him to Zion Williamson in the fact that, like, I think he'd be a good postseason player, but we're going to get into fifth season And we're never going to know because he's never there for one reason or another. And, you know, with Derek, the best chance he had probably to show that he could be a winning quarterback in the playoffs, he got hurt at the end of the season, didn't play. You know, he obviously was in that game against Joe Burrow a couple years ago. They lost that game. He played reasonably well. But, like, when I look at quarterbacks and I say, hey, I'm not going to elevate this guy above a certain level, it's usually because if you don't show me you can win the playoffs, I'm not going to give you the credit for being like, hey, he has all these stats. Great. But you got to get to the playoffs and you got to win when you're there. And if you don't do that, you don't get credit for doing that just because you feel like you could have if you got there. I spent a lot of time kind of looking at, like, okay, where would I view Derek compared to a guy like Eli Manning, right? Like, and I would view them similarly. I would view their careers similarly. But Eli has two Super Bowl runs. Like, you look at Eli post 2012, not great. But you can't take those playoff runs away from him, you know? Then you look at a guy like Andy Dalton, and I would say, yeah, these two guys are very similar. Neither has had success in the playoffs. Both guys are on these career passing lists. They played for a long time. They played well for a long time, but neither has proven they can win in the postseason. And you can say they're okay. Well, the team let them down. They did this, but you look at it and you say, you're talking about a 10-year veteran. How many of those seasons was the team not good enough? And in those seasons, was the quarterback good enough? That's tough. But how about the seasons where the team was good enough and didn't make it? And whose fault was it then? So I don't know. And I like Derek. I think Derek, you can win with Derek. And that's what the whole argument is about. Stakanova, who is the stand, is saying, like, I don't understand this take that you can't win with Derek Carr. And my response to that would be, if you can, then why hasn't it happened yet? Why haven't you had these 10, 12 win seasons? And you could say, hey, it's coming. It's this year. And great. If it is, then that take will go away. But you're not going to have people interpret statistics and say, hey, he's a really good quarterback and is a franchise leader and can elevate teams to wins when it just hasn't happened. And that's kind of where I land on that.
Yeah, see, Carr for me, I consider him in that mid-level range, obviously. No, I know you famously coined Kirk Cousins, Mr. Yeah. League average. And I think that Carr is, you know, just right there with him. Is he gonna be a difference maker in games? I don't see that, but I don't think he's that bad of a quarterback where he's gonna cost you games either. I know a lot of folks are critical of, you know, some of the picks he might have thrown last year, but it was a pretty good season for him overall.
Yeah, I mean, league average quarterback play will win you a lot of games, and it'll get you to the postseason more often than not. And I think what you see with Derek is, you know, when he's hot, he can win you games. He can get you to the postseason. He could probably win a postseason game. The problem is there's lows too. And I don't think the balance is there. And I would say the same thing about Eli Manning. Like, Eli Manning, the story of his career was he got hot at the right time. And he made Tom Brady pay for it. And Derek just hasn't had that moment. You know, last year, I think if they make the playoffs, they win at least one game. I think the Eagles were the second worst team in the NFL by the end of the season. I think the only team worse than the Eagles in week 18 was the Panthers. Like, they weren't beating anybody in the playoffs. So I think if the Saints got in and hosted the Eagles, I think they win that game. And then, you know, obviously the Lions is a much tougher question. But you never got that chance. And I think Derek Carr was hot at the end of the season in a way that if you got to the postseason playing like that, they would have been a tough out. You just he hasn't had that situation for him. But right. What annoys me is when people look at a guy like Kirk Cousins. And for some reason, like, we saw these quarterback rankings earlier in the year, and Kirk Cousins was, like, way up there. And Derek was, like, 26th, which, like, come on. Like, these are not that much different quarterbacks. Absolutely, when you really right. break it down. Like, these are the same general quarterback. Neither one can run. Neither one is going to make much happen with his legs. But, you know, like, they've been around forever. neither one was a first round pick. You know, these are both guys that kind of developed at the NFL level. One of the differences is Derek played right away and Kirk sat behind RG3 for a couple of years, but neither has done anything in the playoffs. Like we talk right. about Kirk as if like he's this catch all, like, oh, he's definitely the guy that's going to take Atlanta over the top. Like he's Peyton Manning in 2015 or 2016. And I just don't see that because I put him and Derek Carr in a very similar situation. The biggest difference between Derek and Kirk is Kirk has had chances in the playoffs and has failed. Like, I think Saints fans are a little misconstrued on his playoff history because the one win he has in the playoffs was against the Saints at the Superdome. But go look at the other games he's played in the postseason, you know, and so, like, I put those guys similarly. I put Baker Mayfield in that same range, right? You know, it's funny because, like, a guy like Aaron Rodgers, has won one Super Bowl, right? He had that Super Bowl early in his career. And since that point, his career has been marked with playoff disappointments.
Yeah.
You know, they went 15-1 and lost to the Giants in 2012. They've made it to the NFC Championship several times, laid an egg in every single one, but they got there, right? Drew Brees, same way. Drew Brees and Aaron Rodgers have virtually identical careers in the sense of constantly in the playoffs, never got back to the Super Bowl after winning that first one. And that's the biggest difference to me between, you know, a player who has the perception of being a franchise altering quarterback right. and a guy who is looked at as this guy again, you know?
Yeah, surprisingly, Rodgers doesn't get that criticism. Maybe all his for this off the field stuff, but definitely not on the field.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, that's a whole different conversation, and I've waged this war repeatedly of, like, why does Aaron Rodgers get so much credit, but, like, Drew Brees gets so much blame for never getting back to the Super Bowl? And, like, I think Drew Brees and Aaron Rodgers, at the end of the day, are very similar. The biggest difference is Aaron Rodgers is, what, a four-time MVP? Like, for some reason, he always got the MVP love, and Drew never did. Like, the fact that Drew Brees never won an MVP is blasphemous.
It is bunk for sure.
But that's a whole different conversation. But I agree. Like, that's why I think there's two different kind of spheres of quarterbacks, and it's guys you have to imagine what they could have done in the playoffs and guys that showed you what they could do in the playoffs. And like a guy, you know, I asked you for kind of examples, you know, like Joe Flacco is an interesting guy. I don't think Joe Flacco was ever that great, but he had that one playoff run and that defined his career, right? You know, Ben Roethlisberger had two and that defined his career. Eli Manning had two that defined his career, you know, but then you have guys like Geno Smith, Deshaun Watson, Ryan Tannehill. They're three different players, but neither has really ever done anything in the postseason. Geno has gotten there. Like, Deshaun Watson's a guy that everyone outside of the off-field stuff, like if you just erase that for a second, which I'm not advising you to do, but if you did, I think universally everyone would be like, oh, this is our franchise quarterback. What has he actually done? Right? And when I agree with the take of, like, is it a narrative or is it actually based on statistics? I think that's the best example I can come up with of universally people think Deshaun Watson is a franchise quarterback and he has not proven it whatsoever, right? Like people will also point to Justin Herbert, but I do feel like Justin Herbert is a unique case of a guy that has been legitimately torpedoed. Deshaun Watson torpedoed himself,
right?
And I just don't—I don't know. Like, but it is funny to me. Like, you would if you put Deshaun Watson and Derek Carr on a table and just said pure quarterback, who would you take? People would take Deshaun every time, but that's purely on upside. It's not based on anything that's actually happened because all of his stats came in terrible seasons for his team.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. He was amazing, obviously, in Houston before things went to heck with the massage parlor stuff. And just now coming back from that, getting huge money from Cleveland, hasn't had the help. The contract in
Cleveland is insane when you consider what he did to earn that.
Right, it's wild. I don't get it. You know, you thought I definitely at one time would have considered Deshaun Watson elite, but yeah, he hasn't been the same guy.
He hasn't shown it. So that's why Derek's interesting, and I think that it's fair to say, like, there is an anti-Derek Carr narrative that doesn't necessarily match the season he had last year. And whether whether you come at it. And I think that the truth is somewhere in the middle, right? Like a lot of people would argue, hey, it's all garbage time. And you're like, no, it wasn't. And a lot of people would say, like, garbage time doesn't matter. It's just stats. And that's not true either. Like there's a there's always a middle ground. That's why I'm boring, because I always try to hit it.
The unfortunate, I think, thing with Derek Carr is the guy played through being hurt, which everybody wants these players to do. But you know what? It definitely affected him some and his numbers, obviously. So that wasn't up to par. So you're damned if you do almost and damned if you don't.
Right. People want you to play hurt. But then if you play hurt and play badly, people are like, how selfish if you're playing hurt.
You're a detriment to the team. You should have benched yourself.
Right, right, right. But okay, I think it's about time we wrap up this episode. We went through a lot, right? We covered a lot of ground. We talked about Daniel Jeremiah. We talked about the offensive line. We talked about, you know, inventory versus evaluation. I think that's the first time I use that, but it works. Justin Mello, great breakdown of a lot of players. I have to go back and listen to it again, because it's like rapid fire information. It's always amazing to me how much investment he makes every year in the draft.
Amazing wealth of knowledge, obviously. And like you said, how many dudes this guy's interviewing constantly.
Right. And all these players like go different directions. And it's just, anyway, it's great. Mason Smith took a visit to the Saints. I hadn't seen that previously. So that's good info that you found here on the pod. You know, one thing I do want to hit before we go, and we'll talk about this again on the next episode before the draft, but Thursday draft coverage on WWL, we've got, I think this is one of the best shows that goes on all year in terms of content for the Saints and for the draft. Like they have interviews, Mickey Loomis, Jeff Ireland, Clint Kubiak for the first time, basically.
I was gonna say, nobody's heard from Kubiak since he joined the Saints.
Right. Rick Dennison, all these guys, all these coaches are going to be on WWL leading up to the draft. So make sure to check that out. Obviously Dennis Allen, right. Joe Woods, everybody. Like, if there's a coach on the Saints that you want to hear from, you're going to get him on that show. And that's going to be leading up to the draft on Thursday. So make sure to check that out. And we'll pull some of those clips. I'll probably pull that full Clint Kubiak interview so we can play it on a pod at some point this offseason, because I got questions. I got questions, man. And I want to hear about them. But yeah, I'm looking forward to that. That's always a fun day. Our schedule for the pod is going to be a little weird, because there was a lot of time investment in the covering the draft. Like day three is going to be a mess, because right now they could be making 7 picks on Saturday,
and so, then the aftermath too is still with the undrafted guys.
Yeah, right. And then it's not over at right. that point. So we'll get you as many pods as we can. I'm going to try to do more quick hitters after picks that we can get up. But don't quote me. I said that last year and I just was not able to do it. So we'll see, but I do think we have a better handle on things this year than we did in the past, but definitely check that out. WWL AM 870 FM 105.3. You can always catch up with it on the Odyssey app if you can't hear it live, but I do recommend checking it out. That's my long form, pitch. The Diane will be happy.
4 o'clock Thursday, Deuce and Hoss.
There you go. But all right. Thanks everyone for listening. This has been Inside Black and Gold, another episode in the books. Thanks again to Justin Mello. I'm Jeff Nowak. He is Steve Geller. You can follow me on Twitter at Jeff_Nowak. As you see, if you tweet at me, occasionally I'll talk about it. Not always, but every now and then. You can follow Steve at Steve Geller, WWL. You can follow the show at Saints_pod. Till the next time, hoot at. Peace out. Easy, y'all.
And go Pels.
Ooh, go Pels.